from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Big annual shareholder meetings today for the oil giants ExxonMobil and Chevron. And regular as rain, climate protesters clamor outside the Exxon meeting in Dallas. Exxon is already in hot water, accused of purposely misleading the public for years in the past about the risks of climate change. Now a whole new climate fight is being hashed out, this time inside the meeting, in dollars and cents. Investors worried about the climate future say soon oil won't be profitable. They want to know how Exxon, Chevron, and more will handle that. This hour on Point, the fight over the oil giants' business plans for a warming world. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is some of your 401k, your pension, tied up in oil rigs? And is that where the smart money is now? Is the business argument for big oil to move away from oil a pipe dream or stone-cold realism? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me first today from Dallas is Joe Carroll, Bloomberg reporter covering the oil industry and the story of activist investors calling for a new business plan for big oil. After he gets off the phone with us, he heads into ExxonMobil's annual shareholder meeting. Joe, thanks for making the time.
Hey, Tom.
So what is on the agenda here today? What exactly is being pushed, and what would the impact be for Exxon?
There's activist shareholders have put forward some resolutions, various topics. They all basically come back to climate change. How is the company prepared if there's a massive global move to limit carbon? What do you do with one of the most carbon-rich fuels on Earth, which is gasoline? They really want the company to move away from that business, but move to what? We don't know.
You say activist investors. I'm reading here reports that those raising questions include some very big investors, CalPERS and others, some described as a very traditional shareholder groups.
Well, what has happened is a lot of the environmental movement has figured out what, if you want to affect, in the political arena, if you want to affect change, you register voters. And what they figured out a few years back, and they have really started to ramp up, is if you want to move corporations, you buy some shares. If you own shares in a company, you get to vote.
They have tried to put measures into a vote in the shareholder meeting before and have had votes and have failed. Do they look likely to be able to push through something significant this year?
It doesn't look like they'll get over the 50%, but what's interesting is the trend. For some of these resolutions that go through, they get 4% every year, have no chance of going anywhere. But there are a couple that go through, and last year got in the 20s, which is a pretty big sea change, especially an extremely traditional company like Exxon.
Joe, what's the difference between these big American oil giants and Europeans, for example? Are they talking in different ways about the oil business future?
Yeah, they absolutely are. The European oil companies, the super majors, have taken a lot of this in-house. They're not moving away from the oil industry, but they're much more welcoming to sort of the green lobby. And part of that is there's a difference in corporate structures in that side of the ocean than there are here. And part of it is a difference in philosophy. The two really, really giant U.S. companies, Exxon and Chevron, have to a certain degree dug in their heels and said, we don't see an alternative to gasoline for decades, maybe a century. So until there is one, it wouldn't make any sense to quit drilling for oil.
I've seen charts that show very different projections between European oil companies and some of the big American majors in terms of future oil use, with Exxon's business model based on quite robust growth, continuing growth of oil use, more robust than others. Is that right?
No, they're really in line sort of with, say, the International Energy Agency and some of the other broad international groups out there that track these things. I mean, look, Exxon has some of the smartest people in the world working for it. They have more than 100 engineers and economists, on a team that's devoted solely to looking out several decades at energy demand. They do see increases in efficiency. They see increases in renewables. But when it comes down to it, when you look at the energy content of something like gasoline or diesel, there isn't anything out there to replace it with right now. Science hasn't found it.
What are the investors who are raising these greener measures, do they want? Do they want Exxon to go green? Do they want it to go out of business? Do they want it to become a renewable energy company? What do they want?
I think if you had asked them 5 years ago, what do you want, they'd say, we want the company made illegal, frankly, and put out of business. Since they've come, as I think of it, in-house, they put on suits and come to these meetings, to try to rally the support of other shareholders, they realized that that sort of an outsider view simply wasn't going to work. I mean, look, Exxon is bigger than most of the national economies in the world. That's what their annual sales are. So the idea that you're just going to shove them off the road, as one analyst said to me, it's totally unrealistic. But I think now what they're urging is sort of a transition to other fuels to sort of wean itself off of anything made out of petroleum.
Joe Carroll in Dallas, Texas, there for the big ExxonMobil annual shareholder meeting today. We'll be watching the outcome. Joe, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
With low oil prices, it has been a tough time for some of the big oil companies. Here was CNBC in late April reporting on a downgrade in ExxonMobil's credit rating. Not a good signal to investors.
ExxonMobil has had its credit rating cut to a AA+ by Standard & Poor's from a prior AAA rated company here. They say, among other things, weakening commodity prices, also long-term corporate credit issue. Ratings levels are also in question here.
And they've got a kind of maybe scandal going on, accusations that for years, decades, they have known about climate change, about the risks of climate change, and purposely kept that information from the public and supported climate deniers, even as they knew the truth of it. October last year, here was Senator, candidate for the Democratic nomination for President Bernie Sanders, wrote a letter to Attorney General Loretta Lynch calling for the Department of Justice to investigate ExxonMobil for denying climate change. You've got state attorney generals who are doing just that. Here's Sanders saying there's evidence that the denial was real.
Way back in the 1970s, Exxon's scientists did studies and told the leadership of Exxon that climate change was real and potentially very, very dangerous. Exxon took in this information and then proceeded to spend tens of millions of dollars on organizations whose job in life was to deny the reality of climate change. That happens to be against the law.
Bernie Sanders on climate change denial, and that's a whole story unto itself. Today, the issue is investors worried about what happens if and when the world takes active measures to rein in oil use to big oil giants like ExxonMobil and Chevron. With me in the studio now is Shanna Cleveland, senior manager at the nonprofit Ceres, where she leads the Carbon Asset Risk Initiative. They look to divert shareholder capital from fossil fuels. Shanna Cleveland, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Tom. First, I have to admit, I'm a little surprised to hear a Bloomberg reporter parroting some of Exxon's talking points about the investors that have engaged with the company here.
Such as?
Well, to say that these shareholders only care about shutting down the company or are activists is just a complete misrepresentation.
He did put that in the past tense. He said at one time they just wanted to shut it down. Now they're inside and they're trying to work.
Well, he's saying that they're all the same group of people. And whenever you paint with a broad brush like that, you are prone to saying things that aren't exactly accurate.
What do you see?
So when we talk about the investors who have proposed the resolution asking Exxon to stress test their portfolio and their capital planning decisions to 2 degrees, what we're talking about is long-term investors.
2 degrees, let's just rein it back in so everybody knows what we're talking about. This is the goal, 2 degrees Celsius, no more heat, global climate temperature rise than that.
No more temperature rise above pre-industrial levels than 2 degrees Celsius. And that's what was decided by over 195 countries when they came together and agreed on the Paris climate talks.
So you're saying if that's the goal, how does that line up with Exxon's business plan? Does it line up?
It doesn't actually line up with Exxon's business plan. And one of the key things to know about Exxon here is that Exxon releases a report every year called their Energy Outlook. And they use one base case scenario that they share with investors and that they tell investors they are basing their investments on. And this scenario is the one that Exxon thinks is the most likely to occur. Well, that's fine, and that may be an appropriate base case for Exxon to use. But what we've seen is neither Exxon nor the IEA nor anyone else is very good at actually predicting the demand for oil. And so when you look at 2 degree scenarios from the International Energy Agency, 2 degree scenarios from Statoil, or 2 degree scenarios from ConocoPhillips, you see that what they predict under a 2 degree scenario is oil demand in the range of 74 million barrels a day to 80 million barrels a day,
okay,
while Exxon is projecting, even in their most recent outlook post-Paris, 105 million barrels of oil equivalent a day. And that's a huge amount of demand that they're expecting and that they're spending money right now to develop oil and gas reserves that they expect to meet that demand.
So you're saying their future business plans are based on projected use of fossil fuels, oil, quite a lot higher than some of their competitors.
Quite a lot higher than their competitors' two-degree scenarios.
We're
talking about here is the importance of scenario analysis. So a lot of companies, like ConocoPhillips, a fellow American oil company, understand the importance of stress testing to different scenarios. And ExxonMobil even told investors that they conduct internal stress testing, but they refused to release that information to investors and instead only provide investors with their preferred outlooks.
Does Exxon's projection line up with achieving this limit of not more than 2 degrees more rise in global temperature?
Exxon's projection is completely inconsistent with achieving the Paris Agreement. And that's an important point because not only is their oil demand projection 105 million barrels a day versus 74 million barrels a day, but they also explain in their 2016 energy outlook that they expect global carbon dioxide emissions to peak in 2030, when the Paris Agreement makes clear and the IEA has confirmed that carbon emissions need to peak by 2020 in order to achieve the Paris Agreement goal of 2 degrees.
Are Exxon's business plans then, in a word, consistent with reining in global warming, climate change, so that we don't get all the catastrophic outcomes that people fear?
Absolutely not.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's oil giants, ExxonMobil, Chevron, and what their business looks like in the climate change future. Investors, activist investors, are pushing for more investment in renewables, more climate change awareness, more, they say, realism, saying without change, these companies won't be profitable in a world of climate change. Some of them looking to strand the oil in the ground or saying that will simply happen. You can join us this hour. Would you sink big money right now into big oil, Exxon, for the long haul? Is your pension fund, your 401k in there? And who is realistic here? Exxon saying oil use is going to soar? Investors who are saying we're going to be leaving the oil in the ground? In December at the Paris climate talks, President Obama described what kind of climate agreement he thought was necessary, one that reduced carbon emissions while protecting the economy.
We seek an agreement that gives businesses and investors the certainty that the global economy is on a firm path towards a low-carbon future, because that will spur the kind of investment that will be vital to combine reduced emissions with economic growth. And that's the goal, not just an agreement to roll back the pollution that threatens our planet, but an agreement that helps our economies grow.
Help them grow. At a House session in December, Chairman of the House Committee on Space Science and Technology, Texas Republican Lamar Smith, accused President Obama of misleading Americans about climate change.
The administration's alarmism and exaggeration is not good science. It is science fiction. The administration wants to advance an extreme climate change agenda that will damage our economy and have little impact on global warming.
ExxonMobil says this is going to roll on. Here's an ad last year about all the ways oil and natural gas make the world a better place, from travel to electricity to plastics to jobs.
We'd see all the electricity flowing through the devices that connect us and teach us. We'd see that almost 100% of medical plastics are made from oil and natural gas. And an industry that supports almost 10 million American jobs.
Today in Dallas, annual meeting of Exxon, and shareholders have measures that they would like to see voted up, that they say would make Exxon line it up more realistically with the future that's coming. You can join us, 800-423-8255. Got others saying, come on, the world is going to need and use a lot of oil, and that's the way it goes. Shanna Cleveland is with us. She's senior manager at the nonprofit Ceres, leads the Carbon Asset Risk Initiative, looking to divert shareholder capital from fossil fuels. So that's your agenda, Shanna. What change would you like to see in the Exxon business plan, in the Chevron business plan?
Well, what the investors that we're working with are talking about, especially with Item 12, which is the resolution that calls on the company to stress test its business planning for the 2-degree future, is having the company position themselves so that they can continue to thrive and create value through the energy transition that the Paris Agreement requires. So this set of investors is a set of long-term investors who have been invested in Exxon, in some cases for 20 or 30 years, and hold large percentages of the stock. They depend on that stock to pay out dividends that they then pay their beneficiaries with, whether that's members of their pension fund or whether it's folks who have invested through a 401k or 3B. And so they are looking for Exxon and Chevron to reduce their exposure to what we call carbon asset risk. And that's really the possibility that some of the higher cost, higher carbon types of projects that these companies are investing in now mm-hmm. will not end up going to market when demand is reduced for their product, or when people like or countries like Saudi Arabia or Iran decide that they're tired of having the private oil companies take their market share. So it's really a financial risk that these investors are concerned about, and they want companies to take prudent risk management measures. And scenario analysis is a central piece of that.
What might those measures look like to better align, in your view or their view, these investors' view, let's say Exxon, with the climate change future?
Well, let's take a look at what some of the other oil companies who've done this work have said. ConocoPhillips, for example, has now started to incorporate four different carbon-constrained scenarios into their planning. And a few months after they released the information that they had begun to do that, they decided to completely abandon deep water drilling, because deep water drilling has a long lead time, high upfront capital costs, and it's very expensive. It's at the higher end of the cost curve.
Okay.
Look at, you know, Total, who just released yesterday. Total, a French oil company, who just released yesterday in response to a similar investor call for climate risk planning, a 2-degree scenario trajectory for their company, and said, that means we're getting out of Arctic drilling. We're not going to chase the high-cost barrels of oil. We're going to concentrate on getting supply that meets the needs for the next 5 to 10 years, and we're taking off the table some of those supplies that are higher cost and have longer timeframes for returns. And in fact, Total is not only doing that, but they've invested $1 billion in a battery company, and they are already a major share owner of a solar company.
So batteries are kind of an adjunct to a alternative energy future.
Exactly.
Shannon Cleveland, please stand by here in the studio with me. Joining us right now from Houston, Texas, is Ramanan Krishnamurti. He's Chief Energy Officer for the University of Houston, also Professor of Petroleum Engineering. Professor Krishnamurti, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. Should Exxon be taking the kind of steps that some other major oil companies are to redirect its business planning away from long-term, the centrality of all oil? Should they be stopping deep water drilling? Should they be stopping Arctic drilling? Because it won't line up with the kind of steps necessary to rein in climate change.
Right. ExxonMobil, I believe, is not significantly invested in deep water drilling, especially in the Gulf of Mexico. They are invested in Arctic drilling. They are invested in drilling off the coast of Africa. Those are all in shallow water. And so they have significantly sort of diversified their portfolio, even in the oil and gas industry. They do own a very large subsidiary in XTO Gas that is primarily a natural gas company. But you know, going beyond that, I think a lot of these major oil companies over the last 10, 15 years have explored alternates. ExxonMobil is especially pretty large in algae biofuels. Shell had a very large investment in wind. BP, British Petroleum, formerly British Petroleum, BP, significantly invested in solar as well as wind. So I think a lot of these companies are fairly diversified. These are slow moving. Unfortunately, it's hard to pivot in the energy industry. The investments are massive, and when you start to think of the scale and the investments that you've got to look at, it's got to be deliberate. It's got to be carefully thought through. And I really appreciate what Shanna said. You got to look at scenario planning. You got to look at that. And I think that's part of what most of these oil companies and gas companies do, which is have detailed scenario planning. And with the best information from the history, they try to make projections. Again, Shanna was again right that now there's these predictions from almost every single one of the predictors, whether it's the EIA, IEA, BP, Shell, Exxon, all of them missed the targets. Every single one of them didn't expect the fracking revolution to come along and change the course of history. But again, they look in the mirror to predict the future.
But here's the thing. I'm looking at this one line of bar chart here, and Exxon's projecting 105 million barrels a day demand in 2040. State Oil is saying 75 or 80. ConocoPhillips is saying 75. That's a big difference. Who's being realistic about the energy future here? These activist investors saying, come on, be more clear, be more transparent, and maybe think twice about those big projections, or Exxon?
So I think, you know, when you look at it, I think it's all about how you scenario plan. If you buy the argument that the world is going to have 2 billion more people, a billion more people in the middle class, increasing economic prosperity across Asia and Africa, under those conditions, the total amount of energy required is going to be significantly higher than what we use currently. Where is that energy going to come from? And how are we going to incorporate that into the infrastructure? Oil primarily today is used for two purposes. One is as a transportation fuel, and the second is for making commodity and high-value materials. I haven't seen any reasonable predictions for coming up with infrastructure changes that can result in a fundamental change in the transportation fuel idea over the next 15 to 20 years. So it all depends on what the baseline is.
Yeah.
I think, and really trying to make predictions from there.
Shanna, who's realistic here? Are you ignoring a kind of built infrastructure that's not going to be amenable to major transformation? Is Exxon looking out at the world and saying, well, it may not line up with what the Paris Agreement wants, but this is what the world's actually going to demand and consume when it comes to fossil fuels?
So there are two issues here, actually. So one of them is the world has agreed that that achieving the goal of keeping global average temperatures below 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels is critical, not only for human health and safety, but for the economy. And so that means that the Paris Agreement is going to be implemented. And that
maybe. I mean, you've got people backsliding already.
Well, not many people are actually backsliding. I mean, I think Trump
has
said the U.S. has the Clean Power Plan, and I think that there has been delays because companies in the fossil fuel industry in particular have fought it, I think we will see that eventually go into place. We've also seen methane regulations be put in place and agreements by Canada and the U.S. China is making huge strides. And the Paris Agreement requires that the companies ratchet up their commitments to reducing emissions every 5 years. So by 2018, we're already going to have those groups come back together. But what's really key here is that, as Ramanan said, the companies are really looking in the rearview mirror to try to predict what the future is going to look like. And so putting aside whether or not we make good on the Paris Agreement, which is vital future of humanity, think about this. Amy Myers Jaffe has a great slide that shows that if battery prices fall by 50%, then that means oil demand would go down to about 74 million barrels a day. So it's not just a question of climate policies. It's also a question of technology innovation. And it's a question of the financial market recognizing that climate change has significant economic impacts, not only on the fossil fuel sector, but on GDP as a whole.
Exxon is powerful. Are you worried that if they set their projections up high and then they base their business plans on that, then that they will bring their muscle to bear on the rest of the world to create a circumstance in which they can pursue exactly that goal? Is that your worry here?
Well, what I'm worried about is misaligned incentives, right? So if Exxon is planning their business strategy around a demand future that implicates a 4 degree or 5 degree or 7 degree rise in temperatures, then they are going to have an incentive to lobby for keeping policies to go into place that would limit the temperature rise to 2 degrees.
Ramanan Krishnamurti in Houston. Shannon Cleveland with me here in Boston. Please stand by. I want to welcome Amy Myers Jaffe into our conversation from Davis, California. She's Executive Director for Energy and Sustainability at the University of California, Davis, Chair of the Global Agenda Council on the Future of Oil and Gas at the World Economic Forum at Davos. Amy Myers Jaffe, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Who's realistic here about the future and what it requires when it comes to business plans of our oil giants?
Well, I think really the point is neither ExxonMobil or the U.S. Department of Energy or pretty much any very talented outfit out there has accurately forecast demand for oil in the last 20 years. And we've seen tremendous technological change. You know, you can just pick up your smartphone and know today that the way you get yourself around Boston or some of your listeners are in other cities, you know, is different today. And some of that is going to happen at increased productivity. People might not need to own a car in certain places. People might reduce the trips. We're going to see a massive transformation in how freight is regulated.
I take your point, but Exxon is still looking at 105 million barrels a day in 2040, daily demand. Does that look realistic to you or not?
What I would say to you is that's not the point. The point is, if I'm an investor in ExxonMobil stock, this is a company that has already destroyed value. The majors announced in the last month that they are abandoning $2.5 billion in U.S. Arctic drilling rights. This is a company that has invested billions and billions of dollars in projects in the Arctic and Russia that are not going to pan out, and that turned out to be way more expensive than the company anticipated. So as an investor, what an investor wants to know is, as this company deploys capital in the future, are they going to be able to deliver the returns that they promised? Now, Bloomberg had a survey that showed, you know, Exxon stress tests its investments to try to reap 17% return on capital.
Yep.
What Bloomberg found is that they're only reaping 7% return on capital. And the question for an investor is, if a company has too optimistic a forecast, are they going to make mistakes in terms of their investments in downstream products? Are they going to their Exxon's forecast, for example, projects this very lofty demand in for freight for trucks. But the state of California is now implementing a sustainable freight policy. Europe already has one. China is looking at it, too. So as regulators try to reduce the amount of fuel that is used in the trucking industry, you know, how is that going to affect Exxon's forecast? Could make that forecast very incorrect.
Ramanan, do you think Exxon is too optimistic in its projections of the oil future? How much oil we're going to be using?
I think it really comes down to Asia and Africa. I think focusing on the U.S. market and
oil Europe, goes everywhere. Oil goes everywhere.
Oil goes everywhere, and that's where the demand is going to be increasingly. And I think you got to look at those economies and try to see if it makes sense that actually the oil demand is going to go up. Based on everything we've seen, based on the infrastructure that China has put in, you're going to see a massive increase in gasoline and diesel use in China. Likewise in India. Likewise, you're going to see in Africa. So I think, from a straightforward just analysis perspective, I think you've got to look at those. You don't look at the U.S., you don't look at Europe. My expectation is that demand will go up.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's oil giants, ExxonMobil, Chevron, and what their business looks like in the climate change future. You've got investors at big annual meetings today pushing measures that would call for more transparency, more review of how they see the demand for oil in the years ahead, wondering if what they project, what their profits are projected to depend on, lines up with what will be, or what some hope will be, in terms of reining in climate change, reining in the use of fossil fuels. Shannon Cleveland is with me in the studio. She's with the nonprofit Ceres, leads the Carbon Asset Risk Initiative there, seeks to divert shareholder capital from fossil fuels. Their agenda is very plain. She's also looking at what the future holds. Ramanan Krishnamurti is with us from the University of Houston, a professor of petroleum engineering there. Amy Myers Jaffe is with us. She is chair of the Global Agenda Council on the Future of Oil and Gas at the World Economic Forum at Davos, and she's at the University of California, Davis. You can join us this hour. If Exxon is counting on big oil use for its profits, will they force the world to go there somehow, or are we just going there anyway? Who sounds realistic to you in this look ahead? Here's President Obama at the Paris Climate Talks.
It's not the question is not to be a bad guy or a good guy. I think, the world is not black and white. And I'm fully convinced that for this climate change, if we are all serious, all energy companies with strong human capacity, strong technology capacity, strong financial capacities are clearly part of the solution. If we don't step in this issue, nothing will move or very little will move. So it's better to see that as positive rather than to fight against us.
Well, no, that was not President Obama practicing his French accent. That was the CEO of the French oil company Total, Patrick Pouyanné, saying his industry needs to work with others on climate. Say, let's get in here and do it. And he's an oil guy. Jeff in Des Moines, Iowa. Jeff, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I think we're just suffering from liberal unimagination.
Okay. Where? How?
Well, there's always going to be a need for oil in the world. These corporations are continuing their business models. In 1904, when Farish and Robert Lee Blaffer started Humble Oil in Texas, they didn't worry about all the stuff about panicking and stuff.
Yeah, but that was 100 years ago, Jeff. Do you see a reason now to think about maybe reining in oil use, or do you still just let it roll no matter what?
Well, I think we don't rein in oil use until no one wants to use oil. But we have to think like our founding fathers as wildcatters to continue the march to energy sustainability, and oil will just be like a steam engine from the past.
So, but what does that mean? If you're an investor in Exxon, don't you still want to know what that future holds and project realistically for it? So if you're just as an investor, don't you want it to stay profitable?
Yeah, but if you're an investor, you have the consumer is the educated consumer is the best customer. Anyone investing in oil knows what they're doing and has research to back it up. You just don't start investing in stock just because it's glamorous. Those same people are investing in solar, wind power, geothermal, tidal energy products, and Exxon. You would have to bet that they are counting and investing, maybe secretly, but just in all those products to keep their bottom line fat and healthy for generations to come.
Jeff, we've got it. I appreciate your call. Shanna, let's not sweat this. The market will work here. Exxon will look at the world. Investors will look at the world. They'll make wise decisions, and this will all sort out properly.
Well, let's talk about that. So the points that Ramanan was making before the break and the points that Jeff just made rely upon a few assumptions. One of those assumptions is that as population grows, we'll see greater demand for energy, and that the demand for energy will be met primarily as it's been met in the past by oil and gas and coal.
And he's looking at Asia and Africa and saying that's the infrastructure. That looks like where they're headed to him.
So based on the recent moves that China and India have been making and some of the moves that have been happening in Africa, I would say that that's not necessarily the case. In fact, what we've seen as China and India have begun to have emerging middle classes is that one of the key pieces that the emerging middle class cares about is quality of life. And when you're relying heavily on oil and natural gas and coal, you end up with days where you have air quality alerts and people can't go outside and people can't see. And you've seen the
Beijing,
popular
yeah,
rebellion
terrible.
In
yeah.
China and in India over that issue. So you've got not only the market policies and the regulatory issues that are going to ensue the Paris Agreement. But you've also got, you know, the demands and desires of people who are rising up into the middle class. You know, curing energy poverty doesn't demand that we expand oil and natural gas across the earth. What it demands is that we bring people clean, affordable energy, and that includes solar, energy storage, wind, and other types of products. The other issue here is that we have the investors that are engaged here are long-term investors. They want to see Exxon continue to provide them with dividends. Well, that's not what's been happening over the last 18 to 24 months. Since the oil price collapsed in December of 2014, Wood Mackenzie tracked over $380 billion in deferred or canceled projects. You've seen Exxon lose its AAA rating and have to go into debt, issue $12 billion worth of bonds to pay their dividends. And so investors want to know that these companies are viewing this for what it is, which is, as Ali al-Naimi, the former oil minister of Saudi Arabia, said, an existential threat to the oil industry.
Amy Myers Jaffe, what about it? I mean, I'm looking here at Ann Simpson at CalPERS. They've got $1 billion worth of Exxon shares, and they're supporting some of these measures on the docket today. She's quoted here saying companies like Exxon and Chevron, this is a huge investor. She says they're clinging to bygone assumptions. This is their Kodak moment. If they want to still be in business in 30 years, they have to understand the changes that are taking place. Our caller says, look, they're smart. They're paying attention. We can pretty much count on them to do the right thing. Do you, Amy, can we count on Exxon to make the right moves here, the right plans?
Well, I think that fundamentally the caller has an interesting perspective, but here is what shareholders are asking for. He is assuming that Exxon's management is going to make the right decisions. All investors are saying is we want to see evidence that Exxon is going to make the right decisions. So we want to know how is Exxon thinking about this problem. So no one's asking Exxon to change their base forecast. What people are asking Exxon to do is to disclose some perspective on how they would handle it if the energy transition happens faster than they're expecting.
Why not do that? Why fight that? And they clearly have been resistant to these measures.
And I can't tell you. I mean, some of it might be strategic. You know, Shanna mentioned that maybe they have a political agenda and therefore that to protect and expand the business they want instead of the business that might happen. You know, it could just be they're not smart enough. You know, maybe the caller in was not right about the management and how they do things. All investors want to know is that, yes, we're taking this into account, and we can show you some evidence. What Exxon's really saying or Chevron's really saying is, listen, it's proprietary. Just trust us. We don't care that Total, the French company, or Norway's company have disclosed these things. Don't buy their stock. Buy our stock. And then just trust us. Whereas investors are saying, hey, listen, you know, ConocoPhillips, Total, Shell, they're giving us this information for which we can make a good judgment as investors. And why are you, Exxon and Chevron, telling us that you can't do that?
Shanna?
So the caller made another important point. So he talked about how these sophisticated investors are diversified into all sorts of investments and that the different pieces of their portfolio serve different functions. Well, that part is true. But here's the issue. Groups like The Economist and Citigroup have come out with reports that show that the impacts of climate change will be felt across the economy. So that means stock portfolios are at risk, even if they're diversified, because the impacts from climate change will have economy-wide impacts on portfolios. So there is no way for investors to completely get away from the risks posed by an increasing global average temperature. So what they have to do is engage with the companies that they own in that diversified portfolio to make sure that those companies are planning to work with the rest of the world towards that new energy future and not flood out the value of everything else.
Steve in Marlborough, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, just a quick couple of points. One of your earlier guests mentioned that the GDP of some of these oil companies is greater than a large amount of nations. And historically, since power corrupts, and this represents a large amount of power, why in God's name would we ever believe what they have to say about alternatives? It just seems to me like a farmer turning to the fox that somehow has ended up guarding the head house and saying, hey, how are the chickens inside? Are they doing all right? The fox isn't going to say, oh, they're delicious. He's going to say, no, everything's fine. Just trust us.
I appreciate your call, Steve Ramanan. Can we trust the big oil companies to do the right thing? Do they have the right pressures at their back to do the right thing?
I think the jury is out on that, right? And every single time.
Is it really? I mean, we've seen all this evidence that Exxon deliberately misled the public about their internal understanding of the risk of climate change and supported climate change deniers to sort of confuse and muddle the debate over that. Isn't that an important indicator that perhaps their credibility is less than sterling here?
Absolutely. These are all important considerations. I think the focus, I think, has to be on greenhouse gases and how you mitigate it. I think the prescriptive ideas of how to go forward with that are extremely dangerous, especially given the market capitalization required to get some of these changes done. And there will be mistakes made. In every space, you make mistakes, and renewables will make mistakes. I think these companies owe it to their shareholders to wait for the technologies to mature and then make their investments. And I think any smart investor would require the technology to mature. And that's where I think we are at this point. And I think trying to tip your hand too early in this process leads to disastrous consequences. Ask Shell, ask BP, what happened with their early forays into renewables. Perhaps the one company which still is in the renewable business is ExxonMobil with their algae biofuels.
Let me get Maria from Walcott, Vermont. Maria, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for talking about climate change. I would like to make a comment about the culture of climate change. This is an all-hands-on-deck moment. And these arguments about what Exxon is going to do, even though I believe they deserve their hot seat in the inferno, can't be the whole picture. People have to conserve themselves. And you never hear in these conversations, what is the energy for? Is it for riding mowers and jet skis and snowmobiles? Is it for something essential? People think that they can live their lives the way they always have. Change is inevitable. We have to get rid of these memes like the summer driving season and pain at the pump whenever the gas goes up 25 cents. I would like to see $10 a gallon gas, and I want to see people conserve.
Maria, I appreciate your call. Amy, are we asking more of Exxon with these measures than we're asking of ourselves?
Well, I think that, you know, for sure the caller is correct. If we as a nation or even globally care about climate change, then we certainly have to look in the mirror in terms of how we use energy. And there's no question that we can all be more efficient in our use. And, you know, one of the things that has become very enabling is some of these new, you know, internet applications. So, you know, if I, back in the day, maybe carpooling was too challenging to organize.
Okay.
But, you know, today you can be standing somewhere and instead of, you know, getting your own car or taking a taxi by yourself, you know, you can hit Uber Pool.
Yep.
And you can save a lot of money and, you know, carpool with five people. So the question is, and in China, Uber Pool has become a social thing. You have millennials who literally use carpooling just to meet each other, and not even just to save energy. So, you know, how society will view energy use and what kind of applications we might have in our home with having our smartphone decide, you know, what is the most efficient time of day to turn on our washing machine.
Yep.
Or what have you. I mean, these productivity gains are coming. They're very hard to project what they'll mean. And so therefore, this debate about how companies invest really have to look at things. You've got some, like Shell, for example, is investigating whether or not as a company they need to be looking at mobility services as part of their slate of businesses.
Amy, hold the thought. I want to get one more, if I may, from Shanna before we lose all of our time here. Shanna, have you got the votes? By the time some of our listeners hear this, it'll be done. And second, what's at stake in this vote at ExxonMobil today in Dallas?
So we have over $10 trillion, investors holding over $10 trillion in assets who have declared their intent to vote for this resolution. We hope to see a very strong vote today in Dallas. What's at stake here is whether or not oil companies like Exxon and Chevron are going to position themselves to be thriving through the energy transition, or whether they're just going to take short-term measures to get them through what they see as just another downturn.
If they don't commit to what you call thriving, can we hit the targets that the experts say are necessary to keep things floating?
Well, 195 nations have come together to agree on that target, and hundreds of businesses and investors are doing their part. They have all hands on deck. If Exxon and Chevron don't come along, they risk falling behind.
Shanna Cleveland, senior manager at Ceres, with me in the studio today at their Carbon Asset Risk Initiative. Thank you very much for joining us today, Shanna. Ramanan Krishnamurti at the University of Houston, chief energy office there. Ramanan Krishnamurti, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Amy Myers Jaffe, Executive Director for Energy and Sustainability at the University of California, Davis. Amy, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having us.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.